It's been a while since I've put out an episode, which I've greatly missed doing. I'm Dr. Bruce Ellis Benson, and this is On Becoming. The simple enough reason for the lack of episodes recently is that I've been in the process of moving to a warmer climate because of health issues. I was diagnosed with rheumatoid arthritis back in 2022. Scotland's a beautiful country, but its climate, cold and damp, is actually the worst of conditions for arthritis. Arthritis is a term that we associate with aging, though it's a very general term and can denote all kinds of different conditions. As it turns out, these different kinds of arthritis can strike people earlier in life, as early as in their 20s. I have rheumatoid arthritis, an autoimmune disease, which means that my body is attacking itself. Although it's not something that can be cured, it's a condition that can be managed. As you might imagine, it's been a significant transition, and it's continuing. I'll have more things to say about that in coming episodes, but perhaps this gives you some insight into why I'm interested in how trauma affects our bodies. As I've done before, I want to take a look at a relatively recent article, in this case on religion. This one is titled, "It's Easter 2050, Here's What American Religion Looks Like." And it's written by Ross Douthat. Let's start with the title. I'm not quite sure how to parse out this idea of American religion. Is the emphasis here on the American part or the religion part? If the emphasis is on the modifier American, then one might wonder how it's possible for a reasonably intelligent person like Douthat to simply pass over the religions of Native Americans. I suspect that were I to submit this point to Douthat, he'd likely say that the numbers involved are just too small, they're too insignificant. I kind of think that's a cop-out, though. If we don't include indigenous beliefs under the title American religion, then we're not really talking about American religion. Of course, I could likewise imagine some Native Americans wondering if they see their own traditional beliefs as falling into the category religion. It's a very Western cultural category that arises within the Christian tradition, and then, as we've seen, gets applied by anthropologists all over the world. Indeed, this is a basic problem for any people who would be labeled religious by anthropologists, but don't self-identify as having a religion. Let me put this a different way. The anthropologists, even if they were themselves not explicitly religious, were working with the categories of Christianity. For instance, it's widely assumed that religion equals belief in God. But you, who've listened to the podcast, you know better. There are many non-theistic religions. Check out the episode, "What is Religion?" if you're thinking, well, what do you mean? Further, while belief, as in belief in specific doctrines, is an important part of the Christian tradition, most religions don't involve much in terms of belief. Neither of the two other religions of the book, Judaism or Islam, require much in the way of belief. In both cases, they're mainly about practice. Put another way, in the Christian tradition, the differences between different traditions within the wider tradition are most often expressed in doctrinal terms. That's how we normally distinguish between, say, Episcopalians from Baptists from Roman Catholics. To be sure, these traditions also express themselves in various practices. Worship in an Episcopal church follows the Book of Common Prayer. Although both Episcopalians and Roman Catholics would describe their worship as liturgical, and the services are actually remarkably similar, the reality is that all churches have some form of liturgy, that is, how things are done in a service. The main difference is that whereas much of this is written out for Episcopalians and Catholics, there's no order of service for Baptists could be found in a book. Of course, as I've argued before, church communities generally have an understanding to the effect of this is how things are done here, and if there are significant changes made, that may be upsetting to some attendees. But it's important to keep in mind that while many doctrinal differences have always existed, those differences become the way to distinguish between various groups. In other words, given the sheer number of differences that emerged in the Reformation, the only way to make sense of the various groups is by way of their respective beliefs. Anabaptists are fully committed to adult baptism. Episcopalians and Roman Catholics tend to baptize people as infants, with the idea that children will grow into their faith. Frankly, I can appreciate the argument for both practices. But it's important to realize that these differences represent very different understandings of what it means to raise a child in a given faith, not to mention understanding of Christianity as a whole. Here's the difference. In the Episcopal Church, baptizing infants in effect says, you're already a part of this community. You don't need to do anything else to qualify as one of us. In churches that practice adult baptism, you're not in until you get baptized, or until you profess Jesus as your Savior. Now, I should add that some evangelical groups are so disinterested in baptism that it just doesn't really show up as an important trend. My father was a vice president at the Trinity Evangelical Divinity School, which is a school of the evangelical denomination in the U.S., the Evangelical Free Church. And that particular church doesn't have much of an emphasis on baptism at all. All right. So Douthat begins his article by referring to the continuing decline in church attendance, in other words, with Christianity. To be sure, Christianity has long been the majority religion of people living in the U.S. It's certainly not the only religion representing the U.S., but more on that later. The decline in church attendance does not show any signs of abating at this point. Of course, given the history of the U.S., some revival in the future wouldn't be all that surprising. I suspect, though, that such a thing would only be possible if people started to feel as if they needed traditional religion. I've made the point before that for many people across the world, their religion is football, either the American version of football or just the regular version that Americans call soccer. Given that religion requires some sense of the sacred that unites us, it's not hard to see that football gives us exactly that. Exactly what sacred might be up for question. Is it the players who are something like sportive saints? Or is it the game itself? No need, really, to decide one way or the other. Yes, there is no God involved in football, but that just makes it a non-theistic religion. I worry that when I say such things, people might be inclined to hear something more like, oh, football is like a religion, or football is somehow analogous to religion. But that's not what I'm saying at all. I'm saying that football actually is a religion, and that it's just as much of a religion as any other religion. It's where people find meaning and belonging. My only question is whether football provides enough meaning for people's lives, and I don't know if we have the answer to that. My own experience in the very secular world of the UK is that most people simply don't have any idea of what it is that they're missing by not being part of the things that are traditionally called religions. It'll be interesting to see how things develop in the future. I don't think we're finished with organized religion, though I do have lots of questions about what form that might take. Let me add an additional point here. While many people would find the mixing of religions to be unacceptable, it's much more common than people assume. Yes, Christianity sees itself as the one true faith, but Christians have long incorporated so-called pagan ideas, and it is not uncommon for Christianity to get mixed with indigenous religion. In Eastern Asia, where both Buddhism and Hinduism flourish, it's common for Buddhist beliefs and practices to embrace beliefs and practices from other religions, such as Confucianism, Taoism, Shinto, Korean shamanism, and other religions. Christians often forget that their connection to the so-called Old Testament is considerably different from that of the Jewish community's connection to the Hebrew Bible, which is the same text. In effect, Christianity and its various practices are not simply new. Instead, Christianity has borrowed from many traditions over the years. One must not forget, for instance, that the doctrine of the Trinity was worked out in terms of Aristotelian metaphysics. I don't consider that to be problematic in any way, but it's worth mentioning given our current discussion. Douthat says that, and now I'm quoting, diminishment coexists with transformation. His point is that as people drift away from Christianity, at least in terms of church attendance, they are also transforming Christianity. But what Douthat doesn't mention at all is that Christianity has always been moving and changing. One of the points I've tried to make in various podcast episodes is that what would have counted as Christianity has changed so much over the years. If one goes back to Acts 2, one can see that there would have been certain ideas available to potential converts in terms of beliefs, but not a lot of details, and even those details are pretty fuzzy. One way of charting these changes is by considering the various views regarding who Jesus was or is and how these views developed over time. For instance, a first century view that came to be regarded as a heresy was Docetism, which is the belief that Jesus wasn't truly human in the sense that his so-called human body was merely an illusion or else purely divine or something like that. In other words, Jesus was fully God and not really human. That was a belief that was part of Gnosticism, which would require its own episode or probably a few. But my point is simply this. Significant numbers of people in the past have believed that Jesus was only fully God and not fully human. Are those people part of Christianity? Do we count those people as Christians? It's really a question of how many doctrinal errors do you have before you're disqualified? You can probably guess what comes next. Things go in the other direction. Thus, adoptionism is the view that while Jesus didn't exist from eternity, God, that is to say the Father, adopted Jesus as his son. Another view was Sabellianism, which posits that Jesus, the Father, and the Holy Spirit are not separate beings, but simply different manifestations of one God. Tritheism goes in the other direction by saying that they are three different gods. One more heresy worth mentioning is Arianism, which is the view that Jesus is not divine and was created. In other words, here's how things go. At the beginning of Christianity, the humanity of Jesus is denied. As things move along, the deity of Jesus is denied. And Christians have been debating these various views for years. You should know that there's a very long list of heresies, and many of them were denounced only much later. Put a different way, if you had been living in a Christian part of the world in the 4th century, chances are pretty significant that you would have been an Arian. Conversely, if you'd been living in the 2nd century in a Christian region, chances are high that you would have been a Docetist. Of course, the problem is that trying to make sense of Jesus just isn't easy. The eventual formula was that he is 100% human and 100% divine. You probably realize that that's too many percent. To be an Orthodox Christian, you need to accept what is patently absurd from the perspective of logic. Now, I want to make something clear before I go any further. I don't think that human logic is the measure of all things. It's probably very faulty and wrong, at least sometimes. But it's the main tool we have to try and make sense of anything, including Jesus. As should be clear, if we want to affirm his full divinity and his full humanity, then we simply have to put up with a lack of logic. By that I mean we are simply put in the place of being forced just to believe something that doesn't really make any sense. We can, of course, revert to something like, with God all things are possible, but that means that in effect we lay our reasoning down, or we conclude that human reason just can't understand the human and divine natures of Jesus. I think that's a reasonable thought, but I'm not sure whether that one should stop making strong claims about Jesus' nature, or whether it means that we should simply accept what is absurd. The phrase credo quia absurdum means I believe because it's absurd. That phrase has been mistakenly attributed to the early church father Tertullian, who actually said in De Carne Christi, the flesh of Christ, I believe because it is unfitting. Tertullian was arguing against the Docetus. Although the formula of 100% God and 100% human had not been worked out by this time, it would seem that he's arguing against the Docetus by suggesting that true belief about Jesus requires belief in both his human and divine natures, which does seem to end in something like absurdity. That's one way to deal with this problem. Another way, though, is to question the hopes that Douthat would approve, but it's at least necessary to consider this as a possibility. In at least one previous episode, and I suspect more than one, I've suggested that the Nicene Creed asks us to affirm something that we can't make any sense of. The specific belief or idea is that Jesus was eternally begotten of the Father. I find myself absolutely unable to make sense of that. Somehow Jesus is begotten. Note that this is the term used in the Bible for genealogies, as in, you know, so-and-so begat so-and-so, begat so-and-so, begat so-and-so. But Jesus is begotten somehow out of time, eternally. I don't know about you, but I don't know what that means. Note that the drafters of the creed clearly had heresies such as Docetism and Arianism in mind. They wanted to make it clear that neither of these views were acceptable. But let's step back a little bit. Perhaps you find the notions of human nature and divine nature to be fully clear and understandable. But I don't. I have lots of questions about what is human nature. In other words, what is it about humans that would be essential rather than merely cultural or historical? What does it mean in some kind of fundamental sense to be human? But if already defining the human proves a problem, it gets way more complicated when we start talking about what divinity means. Just to be clear, my point is that neither the term human nor the term divine is all that clear. But if we were to press the point, it leaves us with a view in which Jesus is human, which means historically conditioned and finite, but also somehow divine, which means ahistorical and infinite. As you can see, these two things don't go together very well. One of the difficulties is knowing what a term infinite even means. You might think, oh, well, that's simple, it's just the opposite of finite. But here's the problem. We know what finite means by experience. When we start talking about infinitude, then we're talking about something that we just don't understand from experience. Then, of course, there are all the complicated problems. Could Jesus have sinned? The usual response is that Jesus was perfect, and yet he was tempted just like us. Hebrews chapter 4, verse 15, Jesus has been tested as we are, yet without sin. My question, though, is, was he really tempted? Would it have been possible for him to give in to the temptation? Once we get onto subjects like this, it becomes very difficult to get much traction. Put another way, I have read the accounts of those who argue both sides, but I find it to be entirely speculative. Was Jesus really tempted in the wilderness in the sense that the temptations were compelling in some way that one could imagine that he might give in to them? Or was Jesus, if we say that he's also God, not really tempted in a meaningful sense? Let me try and explain this by a very simple experience. Most of the time when I'm in a restaurant and asked if I want dessert, I politely decline. Put another way, I'm usually just not tempted by what they have on offer. So I wouldn't call this, at least for me, a temptation since I'm not actually tempted. I'm not really very interested. In any case, I think believing in the two natures of Christ demands a kind of absolute belief, a willingness to simply suspend disbelief. But there's another way of getting at the point that things change. Often those changes are presented in the form of, this is the true Christianity, the one that people forgot about. If you think about it, you realize that's the basic thrust of Luther's insistence on salvation through grace alone. He presents what Paul says in Romans as something that's been overlooked or not taken seriously enough. Luther, of course, was living during the time of indulgences, which were things you could buy, yes, as in pay money, to offset your time or someone else's time in purgatory or hell. Luther was, quite rightly, I think, scandalized by the idea that you could buy yourself into heaven. As things stand, Roman Catholic theologians today largely agree with the overall point Luther was making. And fortunately, indulgences are a thing of the past. Thus, many of the moves in the Reformation were the nature of what you believed in the past about Christianity was wrong. Of course, given the proliferation of Christian views that eventually lead to Christian denominations, it soon becomes clear that to agree with one group is to disagree with another. Many groups presented their views not merely as one among many, but as the one right one. Evangelicalism has long presented itself as the only true form of Christianity. To be honest, I think it's a little crazy for anyone to claim that his or her version or their version of Christianity is the one true form. Interestingly enough, Douthat contends that, and I'm quoting, the main alternative to traditional religion is a faith in secular progress. It might help if Douthat knew a bit more about theology. The fact is, the faith in progress that he talks about clearly arises out of the Christian context. For instance, Christian postmillennialism was the belief that the coming kingdom of Christ meant that things would get better and better until the world was finally ruled by Jesus. Well, that was very popular in the 19th century into the beginning of the 20th century. And then something called World War I happened. And that optimism was largely gone. But the motto of Wheaton College, "For Christ and His Kingdom," was originally conceived as part of the First President's belief in postmillennialism. My point, though, is that Christianity has been an extremely important part of the idea that things are getting better. One of the things that clearly concerned Douthat is that, well, people are deciding for themselves what they believe. He uses the term neo-traditionalists, which he defines as liturgically and doctrinally conservative Christians, but ones who have, and again I'm quoting, created rather than inherited their conservative culture. I really don't know what he's trying to say. I think it's something like this. Neo-trads, yeah, that's his terminology, are people who invent their own tradition. But if you've been listening to the podcast for a while, you know that all of us come with huge helpings of tradition into which we are thoroughly embedded. The idea that one has newly created one's conservative culture doesn't make a whole lot of sense. In other words, you are already deeply part of traditions that you may recognize, as well as traditions that you don't recognize because they are like water to a fish. So ubiquitous and unquestioned that they simply go unnoticed. But even deeply embedded traditions can become visible to us, and when that happens, we're faced with the choice of continuing to accept that tradition, or question parts of it, or even many parts of it. Note that I'm not saying that you could simply reject the whole thing. No one can do that. I think that's what Douthat has in mind, but my point is that even if you tried, you simply couldn't reject all that you've been taught. You need at least some of what you've been taught to work through the rest. And that's part of the transformation that Douthat has in mind. To get an idea of where things stand with religion in the U.S., I want to transition to an episode of the podcast On Point. It's titled, "What Do American Christians Believe About Their Religion?" Early on in the episode, the host, Meghna Chakravarti, says many American Christians profess beliefs that their more conservative fellow churchgoers find outright heretical. She gives the example of, and here I'm quoting, a biblically heretical statement that the Bible, like all sacred writings, contains helpful accounts of ancient myths, but it is not literally true. The problem with this example is that Christians throughout history have believed various things about the Bible and its literal veracity. Even today, there are huge variations among Christians as to what they accept or don't accept. Growing up, I was told that people who didn't accept the evangelical view of things were going to hell, literally. We were told that we must interpret the Bible literally. But of course, here's the problem. A story doesn't have to be literally true in order to be meaningfully true. Most Hebrew scholars think that the book of Jonah is a comedy. It's not a literal account of an historical person that is literally swallowed by a great fish and held in that fish's stomach for 3 days. You can spend your time asking, how in the world did someone survive for 3 days inside of a fish? But I think you're much better off recognizing that the 3 days are not literal, but symbolic. As a literal story, it just doesn't make any sense. As a story designed to teach a lesson, it's brilliant. Jonah is ordered to go to the city of Nineveh and tell the people that if they don't repent, God is going to smite them. And then, much to Jonah's surprise, they repent. And that's when Jonah gets upset. He wants to see the Ninevites destroyed, and even says that he tried to ditch the assignment because he's worried that God would be gracious and change his mind about their destruction. If you've never read the book, or if you've never read the book as a comedy, let me suggest that you read it from that perspective. It makes so much more sense. And if you pay attention to the details, you'll find that it's a really funny story that contains deeply spiritual truths. The fact that Jonah gets so bummed up by God's goodness is actually the funniest part. Stories need not be literally true, but true in the sense that they provide insight and truth. In the same way, the expression 40 days could be read as a literal time period, but it makes much more sense to see 40 as symbolic of testing or trials. Maybe Jesus literally spent 40 days in the wilderness fasting, but I don't think that's the point of saying that it was 40. The point is that it was a long period of fasting and searching. The exact number of days simply don't matter. In the Hebrew Bible, the flood is described as being 40 days and 40 nights. Moses spent 40 years tending flocks in Midian before he's being called to liberate his people in Egypt. He was on Mount Sinai for 40 days and 40 nights. The Israelites wandered the desert for 40 years. Are you getting the picture? Yes, it's entirely possible each and every one of these events took exactly 40 days or 40 years or 40 whatever. But wouldn't the text make a lot more sense if we just read the word 40 as symbolic of testing and waiting? So despite what evangelicals, for instance, want to insist, the idea that the Bible is a book that is literally true is not even remotely the universal view of the Bible. As part of this piece on what people in the U.S. actually believe, they interview Scott McConnell, who is the head of Lifeway Christian Resources, which is a Southern Baptist publishing group. He interprets Chakrabarty's comment about the Bible being fiction as follows. I'm quoting. So essentially, this statement saying the Bible is fiction, but it might be helpful. And that percentage has slowly grown, and it's now 53%. To be honest, I don't find that number surprising, though it's clear that to Southern Baptists, this is a significant problem. Why it's not necessarily a problem is that it all depends on what one means by saying that the Bible is not exactly literally true. To say that it is not literally true is not simply to say that it's fiction, as McConnell wrongly assumes. Let me add another point to the discussion of fiction and literalism. There is nothing in the Bible that says, this document is literally true, make sure you read it as literally true. There's nothing in the Bible that says that. That means that anyone is free to approach the Bible or other sacred texts with the assumption of literalism. Yet the insistence that this is the right way to interpret it doesn't have much support. There's not a lot of reason to say, oh yes, this is definitely literal. And as I pointed out before, evangelicals don't think that when Jesus says, "This is my body," he is talking literally. I suspect the main reason for this is that the claim is just a little weird. Jesus breaks what would seem to be a literal piece of bread, hands it to his disciples, and then says, "This is my body." What? We're eating your body? Well, that's what Jesus is reported to have said, and the literal reading of that is, well, somehow his disciples are eating his literal body. By the way, Roman Catholics take this literally, but they have some pretty clever ways of explaining it. But let me pull all of this discussion into perspective. It wasn't all that long ago that Southern Baptists were, well, I think the term would be liberal. But beginning in 1979, the Southern Baptist Convention experienced what has been called the conservative resurgence. That's what it was called by the people who liked it, or the fundamentalist takeover, which was what the people who didn't like it called it. What happened is that the liberals in the SBC were removed from their places in churches and seminaries. That's literal, by the way. On the one hand, one of my friends lost his tenure job to the purge. On the other hand, my father was hired by Al Mohler, the best known of the Southern Baptist conservatives, when my father retired from his main gig at an evangelical seminary. Further, there was an explicit attempt to make Baylor University, which is the most important Southern Baptist university, into something like Wheaton. Yes, I'm not making that up. Baylor 2012, or the vision laid out in the document Pro Futuris, required reigning in the liberals in the convention. I was part of talks with people from Baylor, particularly the philosophy department, about their desire to follow the model of Wheaton in making faith central to the university. In other words, when Douthat talks about transformation, the transformation in the conservative direction is also part of that. Put another way, people often assume that things just naturally progress from conservative to liberal. But the reality is that it goes both ways. Not to mention, of course, the complication that even defining these terms is an ongoing exercise, since their meaning is constantly, even though subtly, evolving. But we're going to stop there. Don't worry, there'll be a second part of this episode that will appear shortly. I'm Dr. Bruce Ellis Benson. And thanks for listening to On Becoming.